I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The partial federal government shutdown has entered its fourth week, the longest in U.S. history, as the White House and the Democrats fight over the president's demand for $5.7 billion to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Democrats are offering far less than that for border security, but no wall, but only after Trump agrees to reopen the government. Meanwhile, 800,000 federal workers have been furloughed or are working without getting paid. Here's Kevin Hassett. He's chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisers, speaking yesterday on the PBS NewsHour.
Workers are furloughed, and right now it's about 25% of government workers are furloughed, which means that they are not allowed to go to work. But then when the shutdown ends, they go back to work and they get their back pay. A huge share of government workers were going to take vacation days, say between Christmas and New Year's. And then we have a shutdown, and so they can't go to work, and so then they have the vacation, but they don't have to use their vacation days. And then they come back, and then they get their back pay, then they're, in some sense, they're better off.
We asked Christopher Perks to join us. He's the Philadelphia president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, who are all wondering when their next paycheck will arrive. Christopher Perks, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. When's the last time air traffic controllers in Philadelphia got a paycheck?
Oh, that would be about 5 weeks ago.
About 5 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So no one's gotten paid since then?
No, well, we haven't been paid, in, like you said, since the shutdown began. We had one paycheck that we got to kind of cover the pay period just before Christmas. And just recently, we all got paychecks with zeros on it.
You got a paycheck that actually had zeros?
Yes,
in
zeros.
Where the money would normally be.
It says 80 hours, zero pay.
How many air traffic controllers then in Philadelphia?
We have 73 air traffic controllers, 7 traffic management coordinators, and 4 staff specialists.
And how many are considered necessary employees? How many are furloughed? Who's going to work? Who isn't?
Well, you know, the media says essential, non-essential. We go by accepted and non-accepted. I am an accepted employee. Matter of fact, I have work today, this afternoon. It's funny that that man said I had a vacation, but I have to go to work today. So all of us but the 4 staff specialists are considered accepted or essential. Those 4 are furloughed, awaiting till the shutdown ends before they come back to work.
If you didn't go to work today or somehow didn't go because you were protesting what was going on, what would happen?
Well, as an accepted employee, I am required to go to work. If I do not go to work, I could be fired. So I go to work because I'm required, but they won't pay me. If I don't go to work, they fire me. It's a very precarious situation that I find myself in.
Do air traffic controllers, others like yourself, do you feel like you have any leverage in this fight in Washington?
No. I mean, these appropriations battles happen for a long time now. It's almost always on partisan lines, you know, whether it's Affordable Care Act or Planned Parenthood or this time immigration and a border wall. It has nothing to do with the national airspace system. So it wears on the controllers, you know. You know, we are supposed to operate. We're in emergency operations right now, right? The government shut down. Right. It's our job to safely move the airplanes around the country. And we're highly trained and dedicated professionals, and we do that. But it's only supposed to be temporary. You know, this is a big building here. I'm sure if the power went out, the generator would kick on.
Right.
You know, but that generator is not going to fire the whole building up. And it's only temporary. So to say that man you had on the thing saying that, you know, we're not essential or whatnot, it's like saying, well, we don't need PICO. We don't need commercial power. We'll just stay with the generator for a while. I mean, this is not supposed to continue like this.
What is the mood then in the tower?
Well, you know, it takes a long time to become an air traffic controller.
Right.
From the time you apply all the way to being a certified professional controller.
How long does that take? I'm just curious.
Between anywhere from 2 and 6 years,
right,
depending on what kind of facility
right.
you go to.
And you came in through the Air Force.
I went to the Air Force, and then I got, exactly. So normally air traffic controllers were notorious for, you know, a love for the job. I mean, you have to love the job to do it. And we have a lot of fun. Normally the place is happy. You know, right now, the mood is somber. I mean, we have, you know, nervous, anxious, and angry controllers. And I would suggest that the nervous and anxious ones will become angry ones eventually, you know, as this wears on. It's just, you know, I actually had to tell my members on ways to get no interest loans or no interest credit cards. I mean, while
have you ever done that before in the years
not.
That you've been an air traffic controller?
No, ma'am. It's always been, you know, there were shutdowns for various reasons. It's always been temporary. This has gone through an entire paycheck, and according to the president, this could last months or a year. I mean, I'm a person too. I mean, how long am I supposed to go to work and not get paid? You know, I have a wife and kids at home, and it's just, you know, there's got to be an end to this.
Well, and I'm assuming air traffic controllers, hopefully you get paid pretty well for the work that you do because of its importance. Is there a point at which you think air traffic controllers, if this isn't settled, will be to the point where they're going to run out of money and they're going to think, I got to get into a different line of work?
I would agree, yes. Well, when things like this happen, it's like slowing a freight train down to stop. And then when they open it back up, it's like just turn it back on. It takes a while. So this shutdown has started well before the actual day that we stopped working. So things like the Academy, where our new controllers, our next generation of controllers are, that's just closed.
So no students in the classroom?
No students in the classroom. They're all sent home. They're not being paid. Mm-hmm. Now, these are people that have waited for a long time for this job. It's not always the quickest way to get into a federal job. So they're not getting paid, and they don't make very much money as the baseline. So, yes, these guys and gals are probably thinking about, I might need to find another line of work. You know, as you know, I have savings, I have means, but, you know, like I said, do I have to do this for 4 months, 5 months? I mean, how long do we have to come to work?
I'm just curious, when you all are at work under the shutdown, is there talk about politics and the wall and the Democrats and all the either negotiations or lack of negotiations? Are people talking about that?
Well, there's always different people, you know, different spectrums politically in a large building like myself. But, yeah, they're always there. But now at this point, it's all about just end the shutdown. You know, it's time for us to get paid. You know, you know, this is we walk into the TRACON, which is where the radar scopes are, or we go up to the tower and we move the airplane safely and efficiently. You know, we operate the safest, most diverse, the busiest airspace on planet Earth in the National Airspace System, the air traffic system for the United States. And we're doing a good job. But, you know, that's inside those rooms. Outside the rooms, the feeling is not happiness. Yeah. It's when is this going to end?
That does raise questions about just security, if people are in any way feeling nervous about flying and whether there are going to be enough air traffic controllers or whether they're so stressed out that they can't do their jobs. What can you say?
Well, you know, safety won't be jeopardized, right? That's one thing that will happen. But the longer this goes on, you know, all those people that were getting on vacation, like the White House counsel guy said, they're important. You know, they provide all these extra layers to the National Airspace System. They're a big deal. You know, there are people that provide our operational training and planning and get us ready for the new equipment. I mean, there's certain things that were coming to Philadelphia that have been held off now that are no longer happening, you know, because of the shutdown. And these things take time to spin back up. So the longer the shutdown goes, it's not going to be safety ever, because that's our most important job. But, you know, efficiency will eventually and capacity will eventually decrease.
You're a master sergeant in the North Carolina Air National Guard. How many other people working, especially in Philadelphia, in air traffic are military?
Out of my people, I would say, if it's not half, it's pretty close, are veterans.
Half.
And then air traffic controllers, there's several ways to become an air traffic controller, one of which is via the military. So you go to any facility, you're going to have, you know, at least 25%, if not 50% of them are military veterans.
What would you, if you could talk to the president, if you could talk to Nancy Pelosi, if you could talk to Senator McConnell, what would you tell them?
To end the shutdown immediately. This is not a good idea to let these air traffic controllers and the rest of the safety professionals, you know, aircraft safety inspectors, all these people that my organization represents are not working. They need to work. They need to get back to the business of this country, which is moving airplanes safely all around.
You had mentioned the fact that folks, you're telling some of your people that here's how you get a no interest or low interest loan, and you said you had never really done that before. How long do you think that can last? And I realize, as you mentioned, you're working off some of the savings that you have, but not everyone's got savings.
Well, not everyone's got savings. Everyone has their own personal issues. You know, some people have used their savings recently for their own family emergencies. What about people that have a family emergency during the shutdown while they're using their savings? And, you know, as you go around the country with different air traffic controllers, they're all in different positions. So how long someone can hold on before they look for another job or find other means, it's all going to be different.
I'm thinking about looking for you people are highly trained, and the thought of losing you to another kind of job is worrying, I would say.
Yeah, it's not something, you know, most of us have wanted to be an air traffic controller for a long time. And it's this is our job. We'd love to do it, you know, and to think that we're not being paid, and if we don't come to work, we will be fired. That's a really, really strange place to be in. It's hard to really fathom it.
I mean, it leaves you kind of helpless. I mean, what can you do?
Yes.
What can you do?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you feel the public support? Do you feel as if the public cares? We were talking about you going on social media, which is always a dangerous place to be, but nonetheless, do you feel like the public cares about what's happening to air traffic controllers?
I do. I think maybe they didn't realize it until recently. I think there's been a media outreach from my organization and my union, as well as other federal unions, to really let people understand how this is working. You know, officially you hear, oh, it's only 25% of the government. Well, I mean, it's an important 25% of the government. And so I think as time wears on, I guess the good side is that more people know about it, and maybe more people will get involved and call their Congress and maybe the White House.
As you mentioned, we don't know how long this is going to go on, but eventually that is going to be a crisis for air traffic controllers. I mean, if we are talking 6 months from now, this is going to be a true emergency.
Well, I mean, it's like your listeners understand that we're still people. You know, I have family, I have kids, I have small little children. But when you go to the airport to go on that trip to Disney World you spent years to saving up for instead of going down the shore, or if you have this big business trip that's really going to get your company where you want to be, or if you're just going to visit grandma, you know, we're going to be there. Mm-hmm. You know, we earn our paychecks. We deserve our paychecks. Pay us. Please call Congress and the White House and just end the shutdown. We need to get back to the business of moving these airplanes safely.
And your union actually is going to be in court today. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. At noon today, opening remarks for National Air Traffic Controllers Association versus the U.S. Regarding Fair Labor Standards Act violations and a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Those opening remarks are today. They were supposed to be yesterday, but because of the weather, it is today.
And the argument being that Fifth Amendment, that's interesting, that you have certain rights that are being inhibited.
It's a due process question, yes. You know, we've had our wages taken away from us without our due process. And the Fair Labor Standards Act says, you know, we have to be paid at least a minimum wage and we have to be paid overtime for our work if we work overtime. So, you know, it's an interesting case, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it turns out.
Well, I appreciate you coming in, Christopher Perks, and I do hope that this gets settled and you all not just get back to work, because you clearly are at work, but that you get paid. And I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for giving me your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. I do as well. Christopher Perks, he's the Philadelphia president of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. The federal government shutdown, partial as it is, entering its fourth week, the longest in U.S. history. After this very short break, we'll be talking about Trump and Putin and Russia and some news stories. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're going to talk about two blockbuster stories about President Trump and Russia. On Friday, the New York Times reported that soon after President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, the FBI launched a counterintelligence investigation into whether the president was working with Russia against U.S. interests. Then over the weekend, the Washington Post reported that President Trump, quote, went to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, part of a pattern of shielding his communications with Putin from public scrutiny. Take a moment to digest these allegations based, I should say, on anonymous sources. Here's the president on the White House lawn on Monday responding to reporters' questions about the Post story.
It was a very, very successful meeting. We talked about Israel. We talked about the pipeline that Germany is paying Russia a lot of money. I don't think it's appropriate. We talked about that. Talked about many subjects. But I have those meetings one-on-one with all leaders, including the president of China, including Prime Minister of Japan, Abe. We have those meetings all the time. No big deal.
The president was also asked about whether he has ever worked for Russia.
I never worked for Russia. And you know that answer better than anybody. I never worked for Russia. Not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question, because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax.
Well, joining us is Max Boot. He's Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a Washington Post columnist and a CNN analyst, author of The Corrosion of Conservatism and The Road Not Taken. Max Boot, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back.
You're welcome. Also with us is Masha Gessen, and she's a journalist, a staff writer for The New Yorker. She's the author of The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia, and The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Masha Gessen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Max Boot, let me begin with you, but Masha Gessen, I want to make sure that you weigh in on this as well. Taking these two stories in the last couple of days, Max Boot, are we in some new uncharted territory?
Well, I don't know that this is uncharted for the Trump administration, but it is certainly uncharted in American history, because we have never had a previous president whose loyalty to this country was suspect. And Donald Trump's loyalty is very much suspect. That's why the FBI opened an investigation of him in 2017 to find out whether he was actually secretly working for Russia. And nothing that we have learned in the nearly 2 years since would dispel that suspicion. In fact, I had a column in the Washington Post on Sunday that listed 18 reasons why Donald Trump could be a Russian asset. And every single day we seem to get new reasons, including today the article in the New York Times reporting that last year Donald Trump talked seriously about pulling out of NATO, which would be the ultimate dream for Vladimir Putin to destroy the Western coalition that opposes Russian designs.
Masha Gessen, picking up on Max Boot just said there, is Trump a Russian asset? I hesitate to even ask it, but let's just put it out there.
Well, I mean, the answer is we don't know. And I feel like a little bit of a broken record, but I keep saying about all of these stories, you know, we have to focus on what's out in the open and not what we don't know. Because what's out in the open is actually so clear and so outrageous and so awful, you know, that we don't need sort of stories about the unknown. I mean, we don't know how the FBI investigation turned out. We don't know anything except that the FBI opened an investigation. I'm not actually sure that that's a story that, you know, holds up to journalistic standards. I mean, it's an anonymously sourced story about something that we know nothing about. What we do know things about is the way that Trump has acted over the last 2 years. We know about the way that his meeting with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki went. We know, I mean, to the extent that the public face of it was entirely orchestrated by the Russian side. We know what Trump looked like in public. We don't kind of need those stories that promise to reveal a secret when what we're actually observing is out in the open.
But don't we need, I mean, as a journalist yourself, isn't it important to know as much as we possibly can about either what is stated or is happening publicly, but also privately?
Well, of course it's important to know. It's just that what I'm saying is that that story doesn't tell us anything. It is utterly uninformative.
Because
the opening of an investigation that we don't know whether it was an investigation that lasted one day or 2 years or has not yet been closed. We don't know if there were any findings. And, you know, stories based on anonymous intelligence leaks are inherently problematic because they're entirely controlled by the side that's leaking the story.
Well, Max Boot, let me get you back in to respond to what Masha Gessen just said there. We do know, maybe we don't know, but the report alleges that there was a counterintelligence investigation open. We don't know, did Mueller pick up on it? Did it go nowhere? Are you left with some unanswered questions?
Well, of course, we don't know the whole story, but I haven't seen any serious challenge to the veracity of the New York Times account, which has basically been confirmed by the Washington Post. And the very fact that you have the FBI probing the president of the United States as a possible foreign agent is earth-shattering news. That is something we need to know. And Mueller did take over that investigation, although Masha is right. We don't know if it is continuing or where it stands. But I agree with Masha that what we know just in the public domain is deeply troubling, the way that Donald Trump has kowtowed to Vladimir Putin. But, you know, a variety of former CIA directors, including John Brennan, Michael Hayden, Mike Morrell, have all said that they can't think of an innocent explanation for the way that Donald Trump acts in this supine manner towards Vladimir Putin. They've all suggested that Donald Trump has in all likelihood been compromised by the Russians, and that is a possibility that we need to take very, very seriously, especially when we get a story like the one on Saturday from the Washington Post about the great lengths to which Donald Trump went to conceal his meetings with Vladimir Putin from his own aides, even going so far as to confiscate an interpreter's notes. It mentioned that after the Helsinki summit, Donald Trump's senior aides never got a full readout of what he discussed with Vladimir Putin. I mean, I just can't think of a benign, innocent explanation for this kind of behavior.
How do you see that, Masha?
Again, I don't think it's a question of whether there's an explanation for it, right? We don't need an explanation because what we're observing is, once again, out in the open. Trump's admiration for Putin is out in the open. His willingness to be manipulated and sort of directed by Putin was on flagrant display during that Helsinki press conference following the meeting. We don't need necessarily to search for what was or wasn't said during that meeting, especially because what Trump says is, as we know, often a matter of who his interlocutor is and what he feels like saying at the moment, right? But the larger scenography of it is deeply troubling without even looking for the secret concealed information.
You don't want to know what they talked about?
Well, of course I want to know what they talked about. I don't think it's of great import, because I think that what's out in the open is already troubling enough. I mean, we're haggling over sort of, the way that we accent this this particular narrative. I keep stressing that we need to focus on what's out in the open. Well, not what can be revealed.
I hear that. And Max, just your response, I understand what you both are saying, frankly, but are you more concerned about what we do know versus what we don't know?
Well, I'm concerned about
what we do know, yes.
And to you, Max?
I am very concerned about what we know, but I'm also very concerned that there's a lot we don't know and that Bob Mueller has probably uncovered. I think this is the biggest political scandal in American history. We need to get to the bottom of it. And what we already know is so deeply suspicious, so deeply troubling, it really makes you wonder what else is out there in the classified information that Bob Mueller has access to.
I'm looking at the piece that you wrote. Here are 18 reasons Trump could be a Russian asset. Now, I realize not all writers or journalists get their headlines, but does that headline with the word Russian asset, does that reflect your point of view?
Yes, absolutely.
And an asset meaning a willing asset, an unwilling asset?
Well, we don't know. At the end of that article, I concluded that this is certainly not proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he is a Russian agent in the sense that Alder James or Robert Hansen was. All it may prove is that he was, as Mike Morrell and Mike Hayden or others suggested during the 2016 campaign, is that he may be an unwitting asset of the Russia, that he may be basically a useful idiot who was manipulated by Putin. But it could well be something more than that, because there is also a very strong suggestion that the Russians have compromise on him. They have compromising information, perhaps dating back to his financial dealings with Russia, dating also to the connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians during the 2016 campaign, in which they de facto cooperated to defeat Hillary Clinton. All of that leaves Donald Trump potentially vulnerable to blackmail. And this is not something that you could have ever imagined happening with a previous American president. But here we are.
Masha, you want to respond to that?
Well, I'm not convinced that Donald Trump is susceptible to blackmail. The man seems to have no capacity for shame or even embarrassment. And I do want to interject this one particular detail, that Russian-American relations, on the face of it, are at the lowest point since the Cold War. Right. You know, we have seen a near total deterioration of diplomatic relations between the two countries. What Russia has gotten out of Donald Trump are specific benefits for specific companies and specific individuals. And actually, if we're going to look anywhere, I would look there.
Let me ask you, though, and
can I just make a point in response to what Masha said?
Sure.
Because in the past, I would have agreed with her that Donald Trump is so shameless, you can't blackmail him. But we have proof to the contrary, because, in fact, he paid off a Playboy playmate and a porn star to prevent their stories from emerging before the 2016 election, which suggests that, yes, he is very much blackmailable. There are things he does not want in the public domain.
Masha, you want to respond to that?
That's a good point, although we have also seen that he doesn't seem to have been damaged by the emergence of that information, you know, both what the women had to say and the fact that they were paid off.
Masha, let me ask you, we should talk about Vladimir Putin because he's the other side of this conversation. But what do you make of the fact that President Trump or candidate Trump or even businessman Trump just has lavished praise on Putin over the years? What do you make of that?
I think that Donald Trump sincerely admires a number of autocrats around the world. I mean, his lavish praise hasn't been reserved solely for Putin, although I think he does have a special love for Putin. But he also has admiration for Duterte. He has admiration for tyrants all over the world. I think this is sincere. Again, like a broken record, you know, we don't need to look behind the scenes to see what's out in the open. What's out in the open is that we have a man in the White House who has no use for democracy, who has no use for American ideals as we have known them, and who wants to be an autocrat and has great admiration for autocrats all over the world.
And how do you think, Masha, as I said, we've been focusing on Donald Trump. How about Vladimir Putin? How do you see him figuring into either our conversation or all the allegations that are out there?
Well, with Putin, I mean, I've been surprised by what has emerged from the Mueller investigation. I didn't expect 2 years ago, and here I'm eating crow a little bit. I didn't expect that there would be quite so much. Because from Russia's behavior, it was clear in 2016 that they expected Hillary to win, that they were mostly trying to make trouble in the election. But it does appear that toward the end of the election season, they really sort of put their money on Trump. I think they were as surprised as most of us were when Donald Trump did win. But I think that they've also been deeply disappointed over the last 2 years by how the relationship between the two countries has developed. And the sort of the specific results that they have been able to get out of this administration.
I'm curious.
Can I just,
Max,
I just jump
ahead.
In here?
Please do.
Because I do think that it is accurate to say that U.S.-Russia relations have deteriorated to some extent. And I think a lot of that has to do with the very scandal about the revelation of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. I think there were a lot of indications that Mike Flynn, who was Trump's first national security advisor, and Trump were in fact plotting to a massive giveaway to Russia to improve relations, but they were stymied basically because of the political fallout from this scandal, which made it impossible to do. And Trump has been very uneven in his policy towards Russia. He is so chaotic that he isn't really in control of his government. And so you have Congress and various Trump aides taking tough on Russia measures that Trump then is surprised by and denounces. But he is delivering some real geopolitical gifts to Russia right now. I mean, for example, he is pulling U.S. troops out of Syria, which is essentially handing that country over to Russia and to Iran. He hasn't said anything hardly about the Russian attack on Ukrainian shipping in international waters in November. Russia has paid no price whatsoever for that international crime. And now Donald Trump is even repeating or exaggerating Russian propaganda to justify the Russian invasion of Afghanistan. So I think they're actually getting a lot of what they wanted, including just sheer chaos and disruption in America's government. Donald Trump trashing NATO and the EU, which are major obstacles to Russian designs. I think they are actually getting a real return on their investment in the 2016 election.
Marcia, talk a bit about Russian or Putin-based propaganda, but also picking up on what Max just said there, whether in certain ways Russia slash Putin is winning this in that there is so much discord and chaos and argument and anger in this country over allegations, and people have chosen sides and people can't talk to each other about this stuff.
Well, I mean, it's not accurate to say that Russia paid no price for its renewed aggression against Ukraine in the fall. I mean, Donald Trump did cancel his planned meeting with Vladimir Putin over it. That may not be a particularly high price to pay, but it's not no price.
That's a very low price.
Go ahead.
Russia has wanted more. It has been palpably disappointed in what it has been able to get. I'm not sure that Donald Trump, in his unpredictability and his chaos, is actually the interlocutor, the partner that Russia wants. I think a more predictable and possibly even more hostile partner would ultimately be more beneficial for Putin.
Meaning?
Putin likes to play himself off against a clear and predictable foreign enemy. Donald Trump, in his chaotic ways, is in a sense too similar to Putin for domestic consumption. That said, I mean, on Max's larger point, I agree. Donald Trump has been held back by the foreign policy establishment, but as he has replaced much of it, as he has gained more control over his foreign policy and his military policy, Putin is likely getting more out of him.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Marcia Gessen. She's a journalist. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Wrote a book called The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Also a book called The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Also with us, Max Boot. He's a senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a Washington Post columnist, a CNN analyst, author of The Corrosion of Conservatism and The Road Not Taken. Both of them born in... I guess it was the Soviet Union back in those days. Obviously living and working here in the United States, we are talking about U.S.-Russia relations. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Max Boot and Marcia Gessen about a couple of news stories that broke over the last couple of days alleging President Trump's connection to Russia. Let me play Senate Minority Whip Dick Durbin. He was asked by George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week on Sunday whether he thought President Trump was compromised by the Russians.
Why is he so chummy with Vladimir Putin, this man who is a former KGB agent, never been a friend of the United States, invaded our allies, threatens us around the world, and tries his damnedest to undermine our elections? Why is this President Trump's best buddy? I don't get it. And when he takes the interpreter's notes and wants to destroy them so no one can see what was said in written transcript, you know, it raises serious questions about the relationship between this president and Putin.
You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and tell us what you make of these stories, these allegations, and certainly in response to what our guests have been talking about. Max Boot, we can't go through all 18 reasons that you believe that President Trump is a Russian asset, but give us a couple of the most significant ones.
Well, it begins with the financial relationship between Donald Trump and Russia, which goes back a long time. And in fact, both Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump have bragged about how much money the Trump Organization received from Russia. And we know that as recently as 2016, during the presidential campaign, the Trump Organization was pursuing a plan to build a Trump Tower in Moscow. Now, we also know the way that KGB and now FSB tradecraft works. I mean, this is kind of classic espionage 101, where you dangle financial inducements before credulous foreigners, you put them into your debt, and then you have power over them. You can blackmail them, you can threaten them with exposure, and I think that is something that is very highly suspicious. Of course, also very highly suspicious, the fact that the Russians actually intervened in the 2016 election very successfully to help elect Donald Trump, and we know that there were more than 100 contacts between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. Most recently, we learned just last week that Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign manager, who was deeply in debt to a Russian oligarch and working for free for Donald Trump, Paul Manafort shared with his close Russian business associate who's suspected of links to Russian intelligence, Manafort shared with him polling data that could well have been used by the Russians to target their social media campaign on behalf of Donald Trump. And on it goes. And, you know, the fact that also highly suspicious, the fact that Donald Trump has tried so hard to shut down the investigation of the Russian attack, the fact that he fired FBI Director Comey and said he was doing so to stop the investigation of the Russia thing and then bragged about it to the Russian foreign minister and ambassador, that's what initially triggered the FBI counterintelligence probe. Because by obstructing justice, Donald Trump is protecting not only himself, he is protecting Russia. The obstruction is the collusion here. Donald Trump is trying to make it impossible for the U.S. government to find out what happened with the Russian attack on America, and he is stymieing an effective response to the Russian attack, which he refuses to admit even occurred in the first place.
Masha, let me read something that you wrote. Russian propaganda is cacophonous. That is its single most important distinguishing feature, and it is the one that never fails to confound Americans. Americans assume that propaganda serves a clear, actionable objective. Campaign propaganda is intended to make you vote a certain way, and war propaganda is intended to make you hate the enemy and support the troops, and you go on from there. How do you see, I guess, the whether you call it propaganda or the disinformation campaign that came over during the 2016 election?
I think it's much less clear than the narrative that has been dominant for the last year and a half or so would make it seem. Right? If you look at what we have learned about Russian social media intervention, it's actually messy. You can't actually see it telling a single story or trying to get people to vote a certain way. What you see is Russians trying to mess with Americans, and I think that's very much the point, right? That doesn't mean that Russia didn't want Donald Trump to win. I do think they didn't expect him to win, right? And I'm not saying that the information that has emerged in the last couple of months about the contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia, that information is not significant. It is very clearly significant. But again, it doesn't necessarily make Donald Trump a Russian asset. And I would even say it's not important whether somebody thought he was a Russian asset. Right? It is hugely disturbing that those contacts existed. It is hugely disturbing how crooked that campaign was, how corrupt it was, how corruptible it was. It is hugely disturbing that Donald Trump so openly admires Vladimir Putin and so openly wants to be his ally, and so openly doesn't want to be part of the Western alliance that has been, the foundation of Western security for decades. All of those things, again, are out and open, but you can't find a single explanation for them, which is what we really long for, right? To sort of say, okay, Donald Trump is a Russian asset, and that explains everything. It doesn't explain everything.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it is a duck. And I guess taking that Max Boot, I mean, are we at the duck stage in that you feel there are enough bits and pieces of information that tell a complete story?
I think there is a pretty clear story. We still don't know how it turns out. We don't know the ultimate truth about the relationship between Trump and Russia, and that's something that everybody has to hope that Robert Mueller can deliver. But the story is pretty clear. And, you know, if you look at what the Russians were doing in 2016, it wasn't just muddying the waters. It wasn't chaotic. It was actually pretty focused. The consensus judgment, the high confidence judgment of the U.S. intelligence community is that the Russians were trying to help elect Donald Trump. In fact, Vladimir Putin himself confessed in the Helsinki summit press conference that he wanted to see Donald Trump win. There is no question that was what the Russians were up to. They were hacking Hillary Clinton's campaign and Democratic Party emails, including they started attacking Hillary Clinton's emails on the very day that Trump invited them to do so. And he said, "Russia, if you're listening," and apparently they were listening. And so they released this damaging information through WikiLeaks. They also ran a very sophisticated social media campaign, especially targeted at groups like Bernie Sanders supporters and African Americans, essentially trying to convince them not to vote for Hillary Clinton, to stay away from the ballot box. The Russians even had suspicious links to Jill Stein, the third-party candidate who siphoned off important votes from Hillary Clinton in key states. There's no question that the Russians do like to create chaos. They do like to further division in America, but they were really focused not just on that goal, but as the U.S. intelligence community has assessed, on electing Donald Trump. And you have to ask why, and you have to ask why the Trump campaign had all these contacts with the Russians. I mean, I worked on three Republican presidential campaigns, and I'm pretty sure the sum total of our contacts with Russia was zero. This is not a normal state of affairs.
Well, we're talking about Paul Manafort, Carter Page, Rick Gates, Michael Flynn, to name a couple. I believe, Masha Gessen, something like 14 people lied about their contacts with Russia. Jared Kushner and I believe Eric Prince also tried to set up back channel conversations to Russia. Again, I hear what you're saying, and you're not willing to use the, you know, the word asset, and you're saying what we know is damning enough. But don't we need to know if there were deep contacts between Russia and the Trump campaign and maybe even Donald Trump himself?
Well, first let me address what Max said, because I think that this is one place where I disagree strongly. There's absolutely no evidence that we have seen that the Russian disinformation campaign was actually geared at electing Donald Trump. And I think that the unclassified version of the Joint Intelligence Report is, frankly, on that score, ridiculous, right? If you look at its narrative, it is really and truly unconvincing, right? Which is, again, not to say that any of this isn't significant. Mm-hmm. It is just to say that this strong desire that we all have for a single explanation, a clear story, basically something that will reassure us that Donald Trump was installed by Russia and that history is not as messy as it actually is, you know, that's just not going to emerge. I think it's probably not going to emerge even at the end of the Mueller investigation.
I have to say I'm mystified that Masha rejects the high-confidence consensus judgment of the U.S. intelligence community, which has also been backed up by the Mueller investigation. If you read what they have revealed through their indictments of the Russian hackers, that provides further evidence that the Russians were, in fact, trying to elect Donald Trump. I don't think this is really subject to debate at this point.
Go ahead, Masha.
What we have seen is that the Russians were very much interfering in the election. We have seen a lot of their social media presence, but what we have seen does not add up to a singular effort to elect Donald Trump. It adds up to an effort to undermine trust in American democracy, to undermine the credibility of the election. I think what they were actually hoping to see was they're trying to establish a credible foundation for Trump to say that the election was rigged, which is something that, if you recall, in the weeks leading up to the vote, he was repeating over and over again. I think they all expected Hillary Clinton to win, but they wanted to create enough cacophony to mount a credible public relations challenge to the outcome of the American election, which they expected to go to Hillary Clinton.
But do you think that they feel that they have won?
Do they feel that they have won?
Yeah, that Russia won this election.
Well, I think that Russia won this. Oh, one thing that I also wanted to address, actually, Max said that Vladimir Putin confessed in Helsinki that he wanted Donald Trump to win. Vladimir Putin does not confess. Right. And he certainly does not confess at a press conference that he is running and that is entirely orchestrated by the Russian side, which was true in Helsinki. Vladimir Putin announced in Helsinki that he had wanted Donald Trump to win. Mm-hmm. Vladimir Putin very much wants to look like the kingmaker in the United States. And I think that should give us pause.
Well, of course. But are you saying that Putin is weaker and less of a propagandist than we are giving him credit for?
I think that Putin is dumber and less of a mastermind than we give him credit for.
What do you make of that, Max?
I mean, I think Putin has been playing a weak hand very well. I think he has been punching well above Russia's weight, inserting himself as a major Russia as a major player in the Middle East. He has been expanding the frontiers of the Russian Empire into Georgia and Ukraine, among other places. He has disrupted not just American politics, but also European politics, where he was also supportive of Brexit and other moves to disrupt the Atlantic Alliance. So I think he is certainly not a mastermind, but he is pretty smart, pretty shrewd, and pretty focused. And in terms of what he did in the 2016 U.S. election, you can certainly argue about whether it was decisive or not. And I would actually argue that the Russian intervention did help to tilt a very close election that Donald Trump won by fewer than 80,000 votes in three states. And that is a judgment that is also reached by Kathleen Hall Jamison at the University of Pennsylvania and other experts who have studied the outcome. But you can legitimately dispute whether the Russian intervention was decisive or not. That's something that's very much open to debate. I just don't think at this point you can legitimately dispute that the Russians tried to elect Donald Trump.
Let me, Masha, something you wrote. This was almost 2 years ago. I think it was the New York Review of Books. This was March 2017. I'll just read one sentence here that you wrote. For more than 6 months now, so we have to take that timeline into consideration, Russia has served as a crutch for the American imagination. And you seem to reference that in what you said a little bit earlier about Americans looking for some kind of clean explanation for the election of Donald Trump.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think that what this conversation about Russia very conveniently obscures is that if Russian interference was decisive in the outcome of the election, which I agree with Max, it may very well have been, simply because anything, you know, could have made the difference between getting the 77,000 votes or not getting the 77,000 votes because it was such a tiny difference, right? But what that obscures is that 60 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. And for the vast majority of those people, Russia had nothing to do with it. And I think that that's as important as the Russia investigation is, as important as the Russia conversation is, it also serves to obscure that fact, and it keeps us from addressing the larger issue, which is that Americans elected Donald Trump.
Fair enough. Max, we're almost out of time, but I'd like to have you respond to what Masha just said.
Well, nobody disputes the fact that Americans elected Donald Trump, and a lot of it had to do with reasons utterly divorced from Russia. I think that's absolutely legitimate. But, you know, we can hold two different ideas in our head at the same time. One is that a lot of Americans elected Donald Trump, and two, the Russians interfered in our election, and Donald Trump has a very suspicious relationship with Russia, which leads to well-founded inquiries into whether he has, in fact, been compromised by the Russians. I think those can both be true at the same time.
I wish we could go on, but we are out of time. And my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Masha Gessen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's a journalist and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Max Booth, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a Washington Post columnist and an analyst for CNN. Both of them are writers and authors as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program, download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, sign up for our Facebook listeners group, and you can also tweet us as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.